Welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. It's a nice sunny day in February. Very spring-like, actually. There are plenty of signs of the sap rising. For some reason, my mind is on an ancient topic, which I'm going to call the seduction of the algorithm. And the question is, to what extent is the universe exhaustively described by mathematics, at least in potential? This is a question that goes back to Pythagoras. And Pythagoras subscribed to a kind of mysticism of numbers. He was quite entranced by the beauty of mathematics as it was known in his day. And intrigued by the way in which, for instance, if you stretched a string, a steel string or a gut string, over some kind of resonator, you could play a note. And if you halved the length of the string, the note produced then was higher, obviously, the string was shorter, but it harmonised with the first note. It was, in a sense, a reiteration at a higher level of the first note. And this is what today we call the octave. And it became apparent there was a mathematical description available to music and to sound. And also there was the sweetness of geometry. And of course Pythagoras is famous for his theorem relating to triangles, that a right-angled triangle, that the square on the hypotenuse equaled the sum of the square on the other two sides. And there is a very pristine beauty to the Euclidean geometry. But there was a problem for the Pythagoreans, and this was the problem of irrational numbers. Now, if you were going to do the kind of calculation based on the Pythagoras' hypothesis relating to the proportional relationships between the sides of right-angled triangles, you could end up with conundrums like having to find the square root of 2, for instance. Now, 4 has a nice square root, 2. 9 has a nice square root, 3. Sixteen has a nice square root, 4. 25 has a nice square root, 5. But go and try and find the square root of 8, or 2, or 6, and you suddenly find that you have. If you do it in decimal, of course, that you just get like an endless division. And if you do it in fractions, you never get a pure fraction that really gets more and more accurate the larger you allow the denominator to be. But it never finishes, that we have this kind of infinite calculation. And these numbers were called irrational numbers. Now, it was quite offensive to the Pythagoreans, because they thought that the beauty of geometry and the way in which maths could be used to describe the behaviour of sound and particularly music gave rise to the idea that the whole universe was made out of numbers, and that at least potentially some kind of mathematical numerical description could actually exhaust and completely describe the universe with the totality, with no reminder. But the existence of irrational numbers, which could never be fully determined, which were calculable right the way into infinity, infinite number of decimal points, and you'd still be calculating. Caused the Pythagoreans to despair. Because how does that fit in this picture of a perfectly harmonious universe in which you have the harmony of the spheres and the music of nature? And see, what's at the bottom of Pythagoreanism is the hope that there is some kind of final description. Now, this conundrum, this tension, has played out, and it strikes me it's still playing itself out. And it's between two kinds of mysticism, in a sense, like a mysticism of the contemplation of perfection, in which the universe is perfect, and it's described by simple numbers and simple arithmetic and simple geometry, which of course is translatable into number. Geometry is only a kind of a pictorial arithmetic in some sense. On the one hand, and on the other hand, a mysticism that doesn't seek perfection exactly, but is prepared to fall endlessly into the mystery. And the mystery is represented by the infinite calculability of the irrational numbers, whereas the Pythagorean purity, contemplation of purity, means there is no reminder. It basically means that mathematical, or logical if you like, which is pretty well the same, description of the universe is possible without reminder on the one hand, and that's if you look at a mysticism of purity and geometry and number, over and against the mysticism of there being a reminder, of there being mystery, that however deeply we know, however deeply we are able to describe and predict with mathematical descriptions of reality, that there will be some incommensurate ability left over. There will always be a reminder, which is the mystery. And however further we penetrate into the mystery, the more it opens up. This is a little bit like Lao Tzu, isn't it? It's this notion, the further you go, the less you know, on the one hand. And I call it like the mysticism of mystery. And then on the other hand, the mysticism of perfection can be contemplated through knowledge of mathematics. And there is a kind of finality, a final knowledge is knowable to us. So it's kind of big stuff, really. On the one hand, saying we can know everything, at least theoretically. And then on the other hand, saying that the further we penetrate the mystery of the universe, the more the vistas of mystery will open up before us. Now, Pythagoras had a profound influence on Plato and Aristotle. And Plato was a contemplation of perfection dweller. And we have the notion of the Platonic solids, which derives from Plato's way of looking at things, which are the five perfect solids, which will fit inside a sphere. So all the apexes touch the inside of a sphere. There's like a cube, a regular tetrahedron, octahedron, icosahedron, dodecahedron, and there's just the five. And in Aristotle, the way this plays out is in a notion of the logical structure of the world, to quote a title of a fairly modern book by Rudolf Carnap. For Aristotle, the world has a logical structure. Well, if you followed these podcasts, you'll know that there is a relationship between logic and maths. Even though it's not as a kind of watertight or as one-to-one as we might think. And this was brought out by Gödel in the 20th century. But nevertheless, there is an affinity, can we say, or a resonance or a homology or something of that type. And for Aristotle, who'd really very much worked with the binarism of logic, his logic is mathematical. The world was rather like Wittgenstein. Everything there is the case. It was a collection. It was describable. The world was ultimately describable with logic and propositions, logical propositions, without reminder. And this is something that Nietzsche takes issue with. And it took this long, really. but Nietzsche takes issues with that inexhaustibility of logic that underpins Aristotle's work on logic by saying, no, there is a reminder, and attempting to do a hermeneutics of suspicion on Aristotelian Pythagoreanism, if I can put it like that. And that's interesting. It's a bit convoluted. I may do a podcast on that one day. I may not, because as I say, it is rather convoluted. But there you see this thing playing out. This tension playing out. I mean, another example of the way in which it played out is the story of Kepler. Johannes Kepler, who attempted to describe planetary motion with a great deal of predictability. And actually, Kepler was a court astrologer, and he was attempting to be able to make better predictions of the planets' positions, to make better horoscopes for the aristocrats and princes who employed him for his ability to make predictions. And Kepler spent a lot of time getting the best observations that he could, most accurate observations, which involved him in travelling all over Europe, which was kind of quite arduous in those days. In order to get data from, particularly from Tycho Brahe, who was operating in what is now Denmark, and had the best telescopes and the best observational data. Using this data and calculating by hand, pencil and paper, Kepler attempted to show that the orbits of the known planets would follow the surface of spheres in which was described each one of the Platonic solids. This was before the outer planets were discovered. And if that was the case, that would prove that the harmony of nature, of the cosmos. And of course, what goes along with this is the notion of God as mathematician, that math is God's language. So you can believe this kind of thing. If there is no reminder, if there is a reminder, you need a kind of slightly different idea of God. If there is this ultimately inexhaustible mystery at the bottom of things. And Kepler did spend a lot of time on this project. It involved thousands and thousands of calculations, and loads of arduous travel and many, many troubles befell him in the course of those travels, including having to take a break to rescue his mother from accusations of witchcraft and so forth. Strange times. Interesting times. Anyway, it didn't work. This is the rub. It didn't work. It did come sort of quite close, but it didn't quite work. And he was a stickler for accuracy. And Tycho Brahe's data was actually very good. And Kepler knew it was very good. And with some less accurate figures, he might have been able to fudge it. But he was super honest and said, no, if there is a harmony of the spheres, it isn't that. Then he tried the idea that you could imagine each planet making a note as it circled the sun. And of course, a note or a pitch has a mathematical value, as was known right the way back in the time of the Pythagoreans. So he sought for the harmony of the spheres in that way, by attempting to prove through further calculation that the spheres produced harmonious music, at least on the level of the numbers involved. And he did thousands of calculations on that, and that didn't work either. I mean, the guy spent decades on this. And you can see what was underpinning his quest was the presupposition that the universe can be described mathematically without reminder. But he kept finding a reminder. And it's actually in the midst of doing all these calculations that he discovered, by and by, accidentally almost, the Kepler's laws of planetary motion. And in the works, they actually occupy some footnotes. They're not even in the body of the text. Now, the interesting thing is that a generation later, Isaac Newton was able to grab this work of Kepler's and work through the figures, and using the footnoted laws of planetary motion, which did have a high degree of predictability and which did fit the observations, and through working on Kepler's footnoted laws, Newton was able to infer the law of gravity, which actually is mathematically quite sweet. But it does involve us with some nice squares. And, you know, when we use the laws, I mean, it's mathematically very, very elegant. It's like the force between two bodies is the product of the mass of the two bodies, divided by the square of the distance between them. And then the result of that calculation multiplied by the gravitational constant. I mean, it is sweet, but you start digging down into that and there become all kinds of problems around what exactly is the definition of mass as opposed to weight and so forth. Yeah. And but nevertheless, very sweet and a huge intellectual achievement. And it's almost like Pythagoras came back, you know. Even though the maths was a bit more complex, it still had that mathematical beauty. And Newton himself said that he was reading God's thoughts, because God is the great mathematician. And this, of course, was then the God of deism. Which enabled many of the movers and shakers of the European Enlightenment in the 18th century to retain religious faith, not get into too many quarrels with the religious establishment, whilst at the same time pushing forward with programmes of mathematical descriptions of the universe with predictive abilities thrown in. And naturally that was a massive enabler of industrial civilization. and the rise of the modern age. It was a kind of Pythagoreanism. They raised up a notch that gave rise to modern industrial civilization, which burst out of Europe. And pretty well took over the globe. Now, in the age of artificial intelligence, digital technology in general, including distributed ledgers, blockchain, internet communication, social media, robotics, and extremely powerful technology that impacts on all aspects of life, from medicine to agriculture, and obviously to accounting and to science. You couldn't run the Large Hadron Collider without banks and banks of computers. And it's almost like there's a new level of Pythagoreanism going on here. And the thought that everything's reducible to the algorithm. I mean, how this pans out in that kind of day-to-day level is you get what I call tick-box mentality. It's like school teachers are expected to appraise what they do by ticking boxes, you know. There's this binary. True, not true. Agree, disagree. Tick, no tick. 0, 1. Yeah. And there is this kind of a seduction of the algorithm. Because Pythagoreanism, even though it might not be true and that there will always be a remainder, is nevertheless sufficiently powerful for predictive science to be pretty successful in many, many spheres. And the number of spheres in which it is successful is growing. I mean, in my lifetime, a human being walked on the moon. The human genome was unravelled. The internet was invented. And intercontinental travel became a commonplace. And then even sort of not particularly well-off people were able to do it. And so on and so on and so on. And of course, the, I suppose, big deal, the atom was split and fusion was elucidated. And the whole sphere of quantum physics opened up and opened up and opened up. So this predictive science, it's got it's pretty damn powerful, and it's powerful often in a practical way. And I think it's that which gives weight to the seduction of the algorithm. But I want to suggest, you know, that tick boxes for school teachers, tick boxes for yoga teachers, even more so, is where the algorithm invades and the Pythagorean mentality invades the space where there is a remainder. And no good will come of it. And then I think where this coalesces into a huge conundrum is in the sphere of artificial intelligence. And machines will pass the Turing test. And in fact, the world's best chess player is a computer and the world's best Go player is a computer. So, does that mean that what human beings do when they employ their reason and when they attempt to understand the world and when they attempt to practically living the world and using their mental skills to enhance that living and to preserve that living. Is that nothing but calculation? If a superior calculating machine can do certain human tasks quicker, better and so forth than human beings. And if a robot can fool you into thinking it's human, even though there's no semantics inside, as it were. It's merely syntax, it's merely manipulating symbols. Does that mean there's no remainder? I mean, I think you can see how this works and where this is going. And of course, people want to say, you know, well, will human beings have a soul? And of course, this was Descartes' thing. I mean, Descartes thought that ducks and dogs and birds were all automata, and the human being was the same, except that he had a soul. He had an ineluctable thinking part, a res cogitans. And of course, in this way, mathematical physics got itself a little bit of a license when one of its chief proponents was agreeing with the church that the human beings had a soul. But that reminder might have quite a different character. It might simply be the mathematical reminder. Rather than an immortal, theologically conceived of soul. Now, this might seem like an aside, but I'm hoping that it'll draw everything that I've said together. When mathematical physicists, these are the guys that just, they don't go into laboratories, they don't do experiments. They simply develop mathematical language and see where it'll go. It's kind of, it remains internal to maths. And they try and prove abstruse theorems about this, that and the other, transfinite numbers, number series, all kinds of stuff. But the point being that it stays within its own enclosed universe of discourse. And it is a universe of discourse in which the symbols are numbers, or the representatives of numbers, as in an algebra, and geometries, and topologies, and so forth. But it's a realm of pure theory and pure mentation. It's actually like a Platonic realm. Now, these guys are stuck in their offices in the Ivory Tower, producing this stuff. And a little bit outside there, these are pure mathematicians, sort of eavesdropping at the door. The people who are at the same time as keeping one eye on what the mathematicians are doing, keeping one eye on what's happening in the experimental realm. What results are coming up that are a bit difficult to explain, or which confound current theories, which are anomalous. And they try and match the two up, you know, they try and look for mathematical language and mathematical theorems that will help to describe some mysterious and as yet undescribed phenomena with some kind of predictive power. And then they in turn would be encouraging experimentalists to say, well, look, if this description is true, or it actually works, might be a better phrase here, then you can expect such and such a result if you do such and such an experiment. So this in turn guides the experimenters. So you've got this kind of theoretical physicist, pure mathematician, experimental physicist relationship, network as it were. And it's a feature of this network, this tripartite network, that there are far, far more descriptions than can be used by the theoretical and experimental physicists. There's enough of the realm for it to be just its own realm. And it's almost like the reminder, if you like, isn't so much that we've never got enough maths. The reminder is that we've got too much maths. And that sometimes you reach the point with a set of anomalous results from some experiment, in which even though we've got all this extra maths to consult, it's not enough. There's nothing in there that will help us. We have to wait for another development, or even actively seek another development, or another description, or another vocabulary. Anyway, just to bring this back to where we started, I want to just make a few remarks about beauty. And you can see why the Pythagoreans down the ages would have been beguiled by the really pristine beauty of the mathematical description and when they worked in relationship to the world. There's, I mean, not only is there a pure beauty of the maths itself existing just on its own, that is the pure beauty of the way it opens up the world for us. On the other hand, you can see a kind of a hubris in the ambition to have a complete and final description. And that's not that pretty. And you can find beauty in the mystery. It's perhaps like the difference between a classical beauty or a platonic beauty and a romantic beauty. It might actually be the difference between the beautiful and the sublime. Because encountering endless mystery is an experience of the sublime. It's when you encounter something that's so much bigger than yourself that you're overwhelmed by it and dwarfed by it. And yet that is a desirable, if scary, aesthetic experience. I suppose in summary, I do think that the Platonic mentality has given rise to some follies in modern life, especially as we now have the algorithm and immense calculating power at our disposal of an order that somebody like Newton couldn't have imagined, still less Pythagoras. And the excesses, technological hubris, are actually countered by an encounter with the ever-receding mystery of things. Anyway, that's a bit abstruse. I imagine this one will get about five downloads, this one. Anyway, not to worry. Thanks for listening. And speak to you soon.